The pastor says we are having church. And I begin to wonder what it means to possess a thing you cannot touch.
Welcome to the Poetry Magazine podcast. I'm Ashley M. Jones. I've never met an Ashley I didn't like. Today, I catch up with Ashley Hayes, who is a force of a poet in every sense of the word. Her poem, Temple, is featured in this month's issue of Poetry, and I actually asked her to make a video of the poem, which you can check out on our website. It is truly a gorgeous and cinematic piece that showed me new ways to think about poetry. Ashley and I talked about the South, its memory, and the ways in which the world of poetry has opened to new ways of writing, working, and experiencing the form. In this episode, we rebuke the ivory tower.
All right, I'm ready when you are.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I am so excited. I was thinking back, actually, Ashley. And by the way, that's a beautiful name that you have, Ashley.
I love the name Ashley. I think that you have a gorgeous name as well. I've never met a bad Ashley, so I'm very proud to have that name.
Well, I was thinking back, Ashley, about how we actually met. And my memory is not always the best, so you tell me if I'm remembering this wrong. But I believe I first saw you in Huntsville, Alabama, at Out Loud HSV.
Yep, that's correct. You were featuring for their finals, I believe.
Yeah, oh, I was featuring. Now, see, I didn't even remember that. I was like, oh, Ashley was featuring. Clearly, it was Ashley who was featuring.
No, you were featuring, and you had on this badass outfit, I remember, in these platform shoes. And I was like, yes, she gives me everything I need.
Wow. Now, see, I was all prepared to talk about how I was so excited that you were there. And I literally actually did not remember that I was reading any poetry at all. That I think goes to show us two things. One, my memory is garbage. But two, that you have such a presence that I just was like, well, Ashley was just radiating something so magical. She had to be the one on the stage the whole time, of course. And yes, I was wearing a suit. I'm seeing it now. Goodness gracious. I mean, the older I get, the more things just fall out of my head, Ashley.
True. I'm telling you, it happens. And I'm just rolling with the punches.
Makes life exciting. You know, like that moment we just had, I was like, yeah. Oh, wow, a new memory for me.
Constant serendipity.
Yeah. Well, are you still in Atlanta right now?
Yeah, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. Been here over 20 years. I'm originally from Chicago, but we're great migration folks, so I'm a child of the South.
Yeah, I didn't realize you were originally from Chicago.
Yeah.
But the South is a place that kind of will never let you go, which I guess you can say from experience.
For sure. Absolutely. Once you get that red dirt under your feet, it's no going back.
Yeah, and I also love that you said we're great migration folks. I think there's so many Black people who don't live in the South who don't actually acknowledge that fact, you know? Mm. At least that I've met in my life, a lot of people are like, ooh, the South, like what a mystical place, not realizing you're from here too, you know, it most times.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And my grandparents took trains from Mississippi up to Chicago. It's the same true for a lot of Black folks in St. Louis and Detroit. And I'm very proud of that heritage.
Yeah, I'm very proud to be from the South myself. I mean, it wasn't always that way, you know, growing up, I definitely was like, wow, I got to get out of here. But once I left, I realized, you know, what richness there was here. And a lot of that feeling I felt when I read your poem and when I saw your video, we'll get to the video a little bit later because I have so many questions for you. But can you first of all read the poem Temple and then we can kind of talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I'm going to read this poem, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to sort of talk about it. But this poem is called Temple. It is originally in my book, Smoke, and it will be in the May issue of Poetry Magazine. The pastor says we are having church, and I begin to wonder what it means to possess a thing you cannot touch. I caught the Holy Ghost once. After chasing him in the back pews, held on to him long enough to convince my mother of salvation, then went home and set him free in the wild. How pompous of man to think himself temple. Don't you know I have called out to God and emptier structures? The doors of the church are open. Come sit, Lay your burdens at the altar, eat the body and its crumbs, sip the blood until you are satisfied. I am unlearning how to erect myself as a stained glass home. This pipe organ heart is guilty of calling out to the godless, but most especially men who peek during prayer.
That last line, you got me on that last one.
Thank you. That line got me too.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay, I have so much. Let me organize my thoughts. I have so many questions about this poem. First of all, I want to start with the way that you read the poem. Can you talk about your journey with performing and, you know, even the relationship between performing and being on the page?
Yeah, so I have been performing poetry since I was 10 years old. I got my start as a kid in church, reading poems, and it became a part of my process. It came a part of my emotional life just to be able to write on the page. And I think that as long as I've been a writer, I've been a performer. But performance has been, up until this point, the primary way that I express my poetry, and the page has been a supplement to that. And now I'm sort of shifting gears where I'm writing work and then letting like the video or the audio supplement that work.
I'm interested in what you said about speaking the poetry having been the primary mode that you used in the past. And I've been thinking a lot actually about this whole like page versus stage situation that happens in our industry. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to see now, and maybe you're seeing something similar, that there's becoming less of a divide. Like people are, I think, starting to get open to the idea that all these forms of poetry are equal in their effectiveness and that they are all valuable. But I guess, have you seen resistance, I guess, from certain groups, or do you feel like the lines are blurring as well?
Yeah, so I certainly see resistance. And I think the divide for me is more like academic versus popular culture. I think there's a divide between like poets who came up in slam and then submitted to major magazines or then maybe later got an MFA. There's a lot of rhetoric that says that that's a less valuable form of poetry, you know, that poetry slam is commoditized and all of these other things. But for me, ultimately, it's about the integrity of the art. Whether you are writing on the page or whether you're speaking, are you reaching the people who you're intending to reach? My people may or may not pick up a poetry book all the time, but they may come see me in a poetry slam. You know, they may watch a video on YouTube. So to me, it becomes more about the accessibility of the art. Because like you said, they're all valuable. They're all made to reach a reader, to reach an audience. And so I would love for our goal to shift to that. Because what can happen is that we end up knowingly or unknowingly making it inaccessible to those who need it most. And to me, that is contradictory to what the mission of a poet is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like you're inside my brain right now, Ashley, because I was going to go there with you. Okay, I'll start with accessibility. I love that you use that word. That has been like so close to me as a poet as well. And to me, like you said, the work of a poet has really nothing to do with a classroom, with a university, with even like writing anything down. Even though I am somebody who's like mostly on the page, the poem's work is not working on the paper. It's working within a person.
Yeah, amen.
And so, well, you know, I always tell my friends, I'm not going to preach today. I'm trying not to. Don't make me go there, Ashley.
But while you're here, you may as well.
May as well.
I always say, but while you're here, I love it. Okay, I'm ready for it.
But for me, this accessibility piece has meant so much. I started to learn how so many of us are edged out of poetry, which is a thing that we need to survive. I mean, Audre Lorde said it best, it's not a luxury. No. There is a light within all of us that we have to ignite. I just hate that there's been this gate, you know, built around poetry, or the ivory tower, as it is called as well. And for me, accessibility has meant maybe not in the same way as you, because I'm not as, you know, amazing on stage as you are. But for me, it has been.
Yes, you are.
Oh, thank you. It has been making sure that my words actually have a heartbeat.
Yes.
And I didn't discover what that even looked like until I read Black poets, honestly. It's just that's where the heart was for me. Reading Rita Dove, I remember as a high schooler, I would carry around her selected works like it was the Bible, just reading it, rereading it.
Yeah.
Lucille Clifton is still the biggest teacher for me on how to make someone welcome into the page. And I feel like your poem that you just read is doing that. You know, I feel so invited into the work because it feels familiar, but it also feels like you're speaking truth and life into my actual body.
Mm.
So anyway, let me make this into a question, Ashley, because I'm just
going
off.
Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome. But can you talk about like what it was like to write that poem? What was your goal, your intention when you wrote it?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that. But really quickly, I do want to acknowledge that social justice is the work that you're doing. Social justice happens when we place women in positions of leadership and femmes and Black folks and folks with narratives from the South. And then those stories then become accessible to the reader. So I want to acknowledge the work that the organizations are doing to push that forward. And so writing this poem, I've been waiting to talk about this for a long time, because this poem is my baby. And it actually came out of workshop. So as a poet, usually every 2 years, I'll go into workshop. I'm going in with Angel Nafis next month, and I'm just like over the moon about it. So I try to find a retreat or something to sort of get the work out of me. Because as much as, you know, we're poets and we're talented and we're gifted, we do need people to help us become better versions. And so I wrote this one in Winter Tangerine, 2018, I think I was in, or 2019. I was in Winter Tangerine Writing Workshop, and the prompt was to write a poem using a theme that shows up in your work five different ways, or a different way in each stanza. And so in Temple, the first stanza, the pastor says, "We are having church." So I just kind of break that down. And then the second stanza where I talk about, you know, I caught the Holy Ghost once. Catching the Holy Ghost is a thing in Southern church. But I thought, you know, I thought about the performance of it, especially like as a kid, and the performance of pretending to be saved and then going home and getting into some more trouble. So that's kind of how that came out. And then, of course, the theme alternates, and then it turns more into, you know, I said, how pompous of man to think himself temple. Don't you know I've called out to God and empty your structures? And that's because I was encountering men who thought so highly of themselves, which we should think that we are highly of themselves. But also, like, you are not a God. You're not a church, right? Like, I have found God in places that that were, you know, not this cute and not this pretty. So please do not think so much of yourself. And then the communion part is just sort of a break down of the body and how we consume the body in so many different aspects. And then, of course, the last line, you know, I admit that I have fallen for a man who peaks during prayer, who doesn't care anything about this religion. So this poem took me through kind of a journey. As short as it is, it took a lot for me to craft, because I was thinking about, you know, I'm from the Southern church. That's my roots, from the Baptist, you know, background, from non-denominational background, actually. There are a lot of Baptist churches in Atlanta. So that is how Temple came to be. It came through workshop and then bringing that theme that had been so present in my work and then turning it into a different setup.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you saw me over here gesturing.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, when you said, you know, the thing about men who think so highly of themselves, or people maybe more broadly, but I my mind went straight to men,
yeah,
who have thought that they are God, God's gift to,
yeah,
us. I don't know, you know, about that. You know,
yeah.
I found God in emptier structures. I love that. I love that you talked about the crafting of it. Going back to this idea of, you know, page versus stage, one thing that I've always hated is when academic poets assume that people who are good at performing or who do a lot of performing don't have crafts behind them, which makes no sense to me, because poems don't just come out the sky. Like, you have to make them, you know.
You have like, to. It takes work.
It does take work. I just think it's important for people to realize there's no one, you know, path to being a poet. And,
absolutely,
you know, to value and to assume, you know, hard work when you see a poem anywhere.
Absolutely.
You know, Yeah, this poem, again, takes me through a whole journey. And it's good to hear that each stanza was, I guess, so full of something, even when you crafted it. And I felt that same feeling, maybe even more so, watching the video version of this poem. Just to give a little background, you know, this is our first time as a magazine accepting video poems as part of the regular submissions. I guess I just have been really trying to work toward accessibility, equity in all forms of the work. Some work, like you said, reaches people through another medium that's not just the page.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, my whole like view of what a poem can do and what it can be is just opening every day. Like there's a new way to imagine poetry every single day, you know?
Yes, and I'll tell you where it clicked for me. Beyoncé's Lemonade.
Okay.
The Lemonade album, when she used Warsun Shire's work as the interludes, mm-hmm. I then began to picture the words in different places, probably from that moment. And I realized that, you know, poetry is screenwriting, you know, can be if you want it to be that. And then I realized how few resources there are for poets to produce videos. Like music videos get these $1 million budgets. And I was like, why aren't we treating poetry in this manner. So I'm so happy for the generation of artists that are pushing the envelope. I'm so happy that you cultivated this now genre that people can submit to and think and innovate and create scenes for poems and create even larger stories. I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just glad to have been in the right place at the right time to to see this beautiful poem. And for those who want to watch this video, it'll be on the Poetry Magazine webpage. It'll be linked with the May issue, but there's also a video tab on the website that you can look at to watch this video. And I urge you to watch it and share it with everybody who you know, because it is just amazing. And it makes me think also about audience, Ashley. I think you sort of mentioned this a little earlier in our conversation. But audience is one of these things that's really important to me as well. You know, who am I writing to and who am I writing for? You know, I think I've learned in recent years what it means to care about a specific audience and not worry about the gaze of another audience. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think maybe you already know where I'm going with this.
Yes, yes. I write for Black women first and foremost, for Black femmes. Mm-hmm. I write for Black folks from the American South. I write from Black folks who are not rich. I write for Black mm-hmm. folks who, you know, may not have higher education. I write for those everyday folks who keep the world going and who, you know, watch the news as it happens and then go clock into work. It took a lot of learning, though, to recognize that is a worthy audience and to say that is the first audience. And if you should choose to like it, then that's cool too. It felt weird at first, but now it's an honor. You know, what a privilege to be able to speak on behalf and to those folks, to my folks.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. And it definitely for me was also a journey to recognize how important my audience actually is. You know, I think it definitely is a tool of white supremacy to let us think that our audience should first and foremost be, you know, the white elite, the white academic, you know, so we can go down in history, quote unquote, you know, and be counted as a worthy academic.
Yeah.
I think for me, when it really started to click was starting to actually listen to these foremothers in poetry, instead of just feeling grateful that they've welcomed me into being able to write, but looking at their actual lives and seeing that they also knew who they were writing to and for. I'm thinking about Gwendolyn Brooks right now.
Yes.
When I learned that she left her big publisher and went to a Black publisher, and I said, wait a minute, you're Gwendolyn Brooks. We love you. You know, you're amazing. And you did this for us, you know, like,
and that's doing the work.
Yep.
That's what the work is, to eradicate racism in publishing and classism in publishing, to make those stories that may seem less academic is still valuable because they are. And I got tired of reading the same stories over and over again. You get tired of the same narratives. And so who better to tell our stories than ourselves? But yes, that's the work. That's the work.
Right. And it is hard work, you know, to be in this space. I know for me, I'm in a lot of academic spaces, and there is a pressure to feel like you measure up, you know, to these other people. But when I think about who it is I want to see in the audience, who I want to pick up a book and feel seen, that's kind of where I get my power. You know, when I think of little me, you know, 7-year-old Ashley reading Eloise Greenfield's Honey, I Love and feeling like, wow, I'm Black too. You know, that's what I want to write for. I don't care if you're, you know, Dr. Who's It, What's It, whatever. I'm not writing for you. If you like it, good for you. I'm glad you like it, whatever. But it's for this little Black person who needs to feel possible.
Yeah. Woo. Yep. Yep. And for me, it's for all the little Black girls named Ashley, which I feel like, again, we're like this very special crew. But yes, that's it. And that's what pushes us forward, I think.
I think so, for sure. And we really need it. We need to speak that kind of life into each other. I don't even want to say especially now, especially always, you know, it's
especially always. Yes.
Right. Cause I mean, it's definitely hard. You know, I didn't even realize the toll that it has taken on my body to be like out here doing poetry until the pandemic. And I wasn't like out here doing I mean, I'm kind of back online out here, but you see what I'm saying? Like I didn't.
Yeah. I needed a year off. I didn't know I needed it until I got it. I toured 4 years straight, 26, almost 5 years, 26 to I turned 31 right before the pandemic. And I was just touring hundreds of colleges and universities.
Yeah, wow. Hundreds of colleges.
Hundreds.
Ashley.
And so to suddenly be home and online, of course, it's difficult as a performer because you're used to that in person and the snaps and the eye contact. But my body is grateful that we have been at home resting.
Wow. I mean, here I am, you know, struggling with my, and I am not as deep in the game as you are. And I was struggling. I can't even imagine, like, how were you even able to keep afloat doing all of that?
The reality is that I had doctors, like, honestly, I would be home. And sometimes I'd have somebody pick me up from the airport and take me straight to the doctor. Like I had gotten bronchitis on the road. Like, honestly, like I was sick, but I was doing it one because of the places that I went. So my primary market is liberal arts colleges, which are in little towns who may not get to see a Black girl poet just on an average Friday night like you can in Atlanta or even some parts of Alabama or Chicago. So I felt, you know, it was almost like Dr. King traveling and performing, you know, doing those sermons in those little towns and those little sundown towns. So I felt a call to do that. I felt a call to just bet on myself and to see what places and what people I could touch. So that ultimate calling kept me going. And I don't know that I would have stopped if I hadn't been forced to. And I had to learn how to get on a vitamin regimen. You know, I've been asthma free since I haven't been touring. Wow. Like it really, you know, planes, trains, automobiles, it's before mask mandates, you know, just out here in these streets. So it's absolutely important that you think about it. And we see it, you know, even with larger artists, almost every artist has to make that dreaded post. I'm on vocal rest. I can't do this. This is hard. So, you know, as much as you think about seeing your favorite artists and looking forward to seeing your favorite artists, also think that our bodies have to carry us from place to place. And as artists who are listening, be gentle with yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard lesson to learn, especially always, like I said. But I'm just thinking about these last few, I guess, years. I won't even say days because you don't really have a day off, you know, from it.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, like, it can be hard sometimes to even just get in front of my students and teach them things, you know. I mean, I'm lucky that I'm able to teach with a social justice lens with my creative writing students. Just for example, just yesterday, we just so happened to be talking about Patricia Smith's Black Poured Directly Into the Wound. I hadn't planned that there would be a police murder, of course, but it was there, you know, there's no escaping from it. And that can wear on your body as well. You know, just having to exist, knowing that there's all of these dangers out there. And then you have to come to the reading and people want to see a show. And just the other day I was at a reading and I wasn't even going to read about social justice. I was going to try to keep it light. I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah, air quotes.
That's not really a thing, you know, keeping it light, you know. I mean, everything is light, first of all. Even our sorrows have light within them. But when it was my time to read, I said, you know what? I wasn't going to do this, but I can't just sit here and act like this is not affecting me. I have to read a poem about what's going on. Like, y'all not going to be here just happy on your way when this man has just been murdered. And, you know, I'm thinking about, when am I going to get killed in the streets? When am I going to get pulled over and never see my family again? So for me, self-care has had to become a part of my life just because I'm constantly burdened, not by being Black. And I hope that nobody hears me saying that, because that's not what I mean. Being Black is a privilege, an honor, a blessing.
Absolutely.
But it's the pressure that this country, the society puts on Blackness that hurts. Like, it is painful to do what we have to do. And so it's important for us, the storytellers, the poets, to be all right. You know, we need to be able to keep telling these stories.
Yes, learn to rest. The work will always be there. And so find people who share and lift with you. It's funny enough, this week, Tuesday, I looked on the schedule and I was like, this school is in Minnesota. I end up doing, I was doing a workshop on balancing the scales and social justice to the people who are there. That's what the work calls for us to go to those places that seem darkest and try to bring light and try to get people to be responsible citizens. But you have to be responsible for you first. So sit down somewhere, as the old folks would say. Sit down somewhere.
That's right. Makes me miss my grandmother a lot, who I've realized as of late was a poet. She didn't write any poetry at all. I don't even think she read poetry. She, you know, didn't finish elementary school. She was a sharecropper, but she was a poet. She said these things, you know, the way that she told stories, the way that she laughed. There's this saying that she had, my mom told me, I never heard her say it, but my mom said that she taught them, don't start what you can't hold out. She was telling me it because I'm out here doing too much, you know, as we do.
Yeah.
And when she said it, I said, well, that just makes a lot of sense.
It all seems so simple when you put it that way.
How can I, you know, serve my people if I'm not even able to, like, you know, move through the world comfortably, you know, myself? I hope that we both can stick around long enough to do the work that we've been called to do.
Amen. I believe we will.
Which brings me to this idea of a call. You said earlier that you felt called to do all this work. You were talking about, you know, being out in these streets, a la Dr. King, you know, in the trenches. Can you talk about that calling? Like, when do you think you felt the call? And that terminology, the call, like, that is very, very religious.
Very religious.
So, like, talk about that. What's going on with that?
So my mom's been a spiritual person my whole life, and she said that she heard that I would be a poet and that I would also be an attorney, which is another conversation for another day. I think that I was called to justice. I don't know if I'm called to be an attorney, but we'll see. And so as a kid, you know, I rejected it largely. It's like, I want to be a rapper. I don't want to do any of this. And then suddenly I recognized that poetry was for me first. And then I thought, well, if it works something out in me, then couldn't it work something out in other people? And I had a pastor lay hands on me and say, you know, you'll touch the nations, you'll speak to nations. And again, went home, rejected it. And just like I say in the poem, I went home and put that back where it went. And then suddenly I did feel like it, you know, I got my start in competition and I developed audience that way. And then beyond that, I recognized that that audience wanted to come with me, that wherever we were going, right as my cusp from teenager into adulthood, that's when I started realizing who my audience was and who I was writing for. But I feel so responsible to be a poet, to be a person who speaks and people listen, because there are people who speak and people don't listen. And so I feel like it's my job to take this gift, because I do believe our gifts come without repentance. It's biblical that our gifts come with that. We're given these things, and that you don't have to do anything with them if you don't want to. You know, it may not be an obligation, but it is a thing that I choose to do, and I wholeheartedly say yes to. So I do the work in the world in hopes that people will hear it and be changed by it.
Yeah, I feel the same way about the calling. You know, I don't know that I've ever named it the call, because I feel afraid to say those words, you know, but I also have felt that this is what I was given to do. I feel like if I wasn't doing poetry, I would be just kind of a zombie walking around here. You know, there would be nothing igniting my spirit in any way.
May I ask you something?
Please, yeah.
Why have you been afraid to call it The Call?
I think putting the words The Call to it make it feel like, I don't know, I'm some sort of like superhero kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, pastors are always like, well, I've been called. And it's like, well, great. I'm so glad that you've been called. What does that mean to be called?
Yeah, this connotation. Yeah.
I think I just never really felt, what I'll say is this, I feel empowered now that I'm hearing you say it was the call. I'm like, okay, well, maybe I was called as well. I was on that line too, the main line, as they say.
And tell them what I you want. Called. Okay.
That's right. That's right. And I'm sure my mom also, she didn't, I guess, prophesy. That's not her particular ministry. She does break out into sermon randomly. That's just, you know, what she does. She wouldn't call it a sermon. She would just say, I'm just talking. The Lord has given me the words to say, but it's a sermon. But she, you know, she taught us, you know, we're all given something and we have to do something with that thing. You know, it was a call. I was called, world.
Yeah,
I was called to do this. This is my calling. This is my purpose. And I'm so glad to be walking in it. Thank you for that permission, Ashley, to call it that. So I just have a couple more questions for you. I zeroed in on you talking about your mom. And I was thinking about the role of parents in the life of an artist. I know for me, I didn't realize that some parents didn't support their kids being artists, because I was spoiled by my own parents being like, oh yeah, you know, do what you got to do. I mean, they were always very clear, like, you have to be able to feed yourself though. Like, do all this art, but like, work.
Keep them lights on. Okay.
Yes. And so when I started to meet other students in my high school, but also in college and otherwise, I learned that your dreams can be totally killed, murdered, if your parents say like, that's not worthwhile, don't do that. So I guess I'm just kind of opening it back up to talk about, you know, how your mom, especially, I guess, who saw this for you, what did that mean for you as a young person? I know you said you rejected it, but.
Yeah, but it meant a lot. She and my father, both my dad was a bass player, and he actually played bass guitar on my first spoken word record. So to have two parents, my mom is a singer, to have two parents who were artistically inclined certainly made it easier. It's invaluable to have a mom that will drop you off at the poetry slam, and a dad that'll pick you up, and a mom that'll help you buy an outfit for your first competition, or, you know, a mom that will make all her friends buy a copy of whatever you've been published in or whatever book you're selling, and to help you set up. You know, it's the thing that keeps that made Beyonce tick. You know, she had two parents who were willing to invest in her artistic business, which is the largest artistic business now. And that is something that she can't put value on. But I'll also say this, what my mom found though, because my mom's parents were very focused on survivals, but she was able to find a teacher who helped cultivated her art. And so I do find a lot of kids, I always call them my kids, I coach Poetry Slam, and they say, you know, my mom isn't into it, doesn't understand it, and I think poetry's weird. And so even if it's not our parents, to find somebody who gets it and somebody who can mentor and cultivate and say yes, it is what's going to keep the arts going. I mean, grown people who, you know, they say, I was a poet until my teacher told me I wasn't good. I was a poet until I realized there was a real world. And I'm like, what a world to be in where poetry is a real world and a valuable career path. So yeah, so grateful for my mom, who still to this day, if I get a trophy or get like the poetry magazine, I think I ordered 15 and 12 or she's probably gonna take. She's probably gonna be like, look at this, you know, even still. So that is something that I could never put a price tag on.
Wow, I love that so much. Y'all are gonna make our sales go up so much for that issue. That's amazing. But that support means everything. And, you know, I've had people tell me, you know, your work is a gimmick. Everything you're doing is, you know, not worthwhile. And that, like, it stopped me, but it didn't, you know, completely stop me, because I had other people to support me and tell me, like, this is what you're supposed to do. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. But some people don't have that, you know, and even as Black people, more specifically, it can be hard to venture out into art sometimes because, again, we are here to survive as Black people.
Yeah.
We don't always have the luxury of, well, let me just dabble in a little art. You know, like, we need to feed ourselves, make sure we're not, you know.
But why is art considered a luxury? That's what I want to scream from the top of the rafters.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And so if you are listening to this and you have been wounded in that place, hopefully you hear this and know that your work is valuable. That your stories are valuable. It's never too late to heal that wound if it has occurred in you too.
Yeah, whoever's listening, please pick up that pen or the paintbrush
or the camera.
There you go, the camera, the needle and thread, whatever it is that you are doing, because we need it. We do need it. It is necessary, you know, for us to survive. And art has been necessary for everybody to survive for so long. Like you said, why are we saying it's a luxury? Because we clearly need it. Look at the pandemic.
It's the first thing we ran to, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Hopefully somebody's getting this word out there. You know, we said we weren't going to preach.
But if you would like to donate to the building fund.
That's right. That's so funny. So I wanted to end, Ashley, by just asking you, what do you hope for the future? It's an open question. Whatever hopes are on your heart.
I hope to be able to continue to tell the stories not often told, to continue to learn better, do better, and be better. What I hope is that we do get to see in our lifetime social justice and that restoring of people, that restoring of Blackness, of our humanity. I hope for more love in the world. This world operates and spins on fear. So much fear, fear of what people will think, fear of being rejected, fear of what will happen next. And if we could just operate in love and do the things we love doing and love doing things that make the world a better place, that is what I hope to see.
Wow. And see, let me bounce back from what you just said, because you were speaking directly to me. I don't know if you know like that. That reached me for sure, especially about fear. My goodness. Yeah, I'm going to try to let go of some fears that I have.
I read something. Elizabeth Gilbert in Big Magic, she wrote, fear can sit in the back seat. It can even hold the ox cord, but it can't drive. And hopefully you take that with you.
The pastor says we are having church, and I begin to wonder what it means to possess a thing you cannot touch. I caught the Holy Ghost once while chasing him in the back pew, held on to him long enough to convince my mother of salvation, then went home and set him free in the wild. How pompous of man to think himself temple. Don't you know I have called out to God in emptier structures? The doors of the church are open. Come sit, lay your burdens at the altar, eat the body and its crumbs, sip the blood until you are satisfied. I am unlearning how to erect myself as a stained glass pole. This pipe organ heart is guilty of calling out to the godless. Most especially men who speak during prayer.
Ashley Hayes is a poet and spoken word artist from Atlanta by way of Chicago. She recently appeared on NPR's Tiny Desk series alongside composer Blood Orange. Hayes is the host of Hayes's Higher Learning, an educational podcast for creatives. Her sophomore book is Smoke. You can read Temple and watch the video in the May 2021 issue of Poetry. If you're enjoying the Poetry Magazine podcast, let us know. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not yet a subscriber to the magazine, there's a special rate for podcast listeners. For a limited time, you can get a full year of the magazine for $20. That's 11 book-length issues for just $20. Visit poetrymagazine.org/podcast offer to subscribe. That's poetrymagazine.org/podcast offer. This show is produced by Rachel James. The music in this episode came from Reservoir and Irreversible Entanglements. All these songs were released by the Chicago-born record label International Anthem. All right, y'all, that's it. Until next time, be safe and thanks for listening.